it's one of those questions that sounds easy to answer at one on one level, and it's actually quite complicated on another because it's huge. So I think maybe I'll try and talk a little bit around specifically Jamestown 1607 and obviously the Plymouth settlement in 1620, partly because, you know, they are long-term settlements and partly because they're quite different in how the relationships work out. Obviously, as we talk today, I think I'll be mentioning Roanoke a little bit, not least because of Walter Raleigh's involvement at Roanoke. But since that one doesn't last, I'll start with the two that do. And as I say, they're quite different, not least because I think the two groups of settlers and certainly the people who finance the settlements have different understandings, different levels of knowledge of the spaces they're entering before they enter them and the kinds of people they might encounter. And at Jamestown, I think they went in pretty naively. So they land and they settle on the James River pretty much slap bang in the middle of the Powhatan Confederacy without any real understanding of exactly who the Powhatans were and how they operated. And the Powhatan Confederacy itself was a very powerful entity by 1607. So the Juan Sanaka, who is known as Chief Powhatan, who was in charge of that confederacy, he'd inherited, I think, a group of six tribes, six communities, who were effectively working together in cooperation. By the time the Jamestown settlers arrive, he's in charge of about 32 communities. So he's massively expanded his reach and his power. And, of course, the geographical expanse of the confederacy and the loyalties were quite significant as well. So the English arrive in the middle of that with all the assumptions that we might expect the English to arrive with, that, you know, they are going to, although they are far fewer in number, they're going to likely to be superior in terms of, you know, their intelligence and their organisation and their technologies and all those kinds of things. So there's, in all of these moments, there's a certain level of English arrogance, even though they are actually very, very vulnerable when they first arrive. Powhatan himself is more than secure in his power relations with his people. It's delicate. The further out you get from Powhatan himself, the more kind of enmity and fragility there is to the Confederacy. But he knows he has a large number of people on his side. He knows he has significantly more power than the English in terms of personnel, and he has all the land, obviously. He also has all the resources. The English have very little when they arrive. So the English are kind of expecting an awful lot of themselves, and Powhatan himself is very complacent about English presence. He doesn't really think that they're going to cause him much bother. And he's also assuming, because this has been the pattern historically to this point, he's also assuming that they won't be there very long, that they will either up and leave or that they'll die off. And so they're not going to be a particular problem for him for all that long. So he doesn't understand the power that lies behind them. He has no idea of what's available to them back in England and what might be coming across the ocean after them. So he's kind of attempting to turn them into his subjects as well. And if they won't go that far, then it doesn't really matter. He can just ignore them. They meanwhile need food and they need land. And so right from the very start, there are lots of minor instances of settlers, particularly those who are brought as labourers, kind of beginning to steal, particularly as they start getting hungry. 1609 onwards is a particularly acute period for starvation in the settlement. So right from the start, there are these little kind of tensions that begin to build around food in particular. And the English respond quite aggressively to a lack of food. So John Smith, for instance, spends a lot of time making his way around Powhatan's, the various villages that make up the Confederacy, and kind of threatening people for food, threatening them to deliver, which again is a kind of complete failure to understand the ways in which food is kind of collectively and cooperatively produced and dispersed in the area. So you have these immediate kinds of tensions, and they just grow and grow as starvation sets in. There's much more going in both directions, much more theft, and as the English colony begins to establish itself and begins to develop, they also then start to take land and kind of muscle their way into territories that have been farmed by the Powhatan. So by 1612, for instance, Powhatan himself has been pushed off his own territory to a village further north, which puts him in conflict or in proximity to his Monacan neighbours to the north, who are very much enemies of his. So that kind of creates further tension. And the English then move on to his oyster beds. They move into lands that his people were farming and take them over. And particularly after sort of 1612, 1613, they're taking them over and replacing them with tobacco. So they're not even using them to produce food. So that kind of territorial aggression, if you like, is a relatively early phenomenon of the settlement at Jamestown. And then I think that another thing that's worth mentioning with Jamestown that creates significant disharmony is that there are a number of kind of moments of real affront. So there are fairly early on, when Smith is doing his rounds trying to bully people into giving him food, he kidnaps and takes with him Opechancanough, who's Powhatan's brother and will become chief after Powhatan. And he never forgets that. The indignity of that moment is something that lives with him. So in 1617, when he effectively takes over power from Powhatan, the kinds of diplomacy and complacency that Powhatan displayed, Opechancanough doesn't have any of that. He's immediately set on aggression, on revenge, and on destroying the hold that the English are beginning to get over Powhatan lands. So Jamestown, in a sense, you know, there are moments of harmony, not least when Pocahontas is married off to John Rolfe by the English, which is very much a kind of classic European diplomatic scenario, although lots of historians urge us to believe that they were genuinely in love. I don't have an answer to that. The jury's out on that one. But those periods of peace are really very short. And the tensions, you know, from 1609 onwards, really, there's just periods of conflict and warfare that will just keep rolling on until the middle of the century, that prevent any kind of long-term harmony, really, in that part of Virginia. And I said I wanted to contrast it with the Plymouth colony, because the Plymouth colony settled, obviously, in 1620, 1621, when they finally settle at Patuxet. It begins with a kind of knowledge that's really pertinent to our conversation today, because the people who back the Plymouth colony, people like Sir Ferdinando Gorges, have already spent significant amounts of time in London with Algonquian people who've been brought over to London for various reasons. They already know that there are English speakers there. They already know that they can deal with those people. So they have a certain level of confidence that they can manage that scenario once they arrive there, although this isn't a confidence that's necessarily shared with the Pilgrims or separatists, however you want to view them themselves. So they don't really know what they're heading into. But the backers feel fairly confident. And when they get there, they're the initial response, the people they first meet, who they only see from a distance, but who are probably Norset people, they greet them with fear and violence. So the one approach they have from a small group of people is when they come up to them on the beach and start firing arrows at them. So it doesn't look good when they first arrive. But the next person that they meet properly is an Abenaki man who's come down to visit allies. And he speaks a little bit of English. So immediately their lines of communication are much stronger. And Somerset's English is not fluent by any means, but he's spent a lot of time talking and trading with fishermen, English fishermen, further up off the main coast. So they start with an English greeting, really, from Somerset. And Somerset then reports back to the Wampanoag chief, Massasoit, who will become their kind of closest ally. And Massasoit happens to know of a Patuxet man called Tisquantum, who is, in fact, Tisquantum comes from the place, the village, that the Plymouth settlement is built on. And Tisquantum can speak fairly fluent English because Tisquantum has spent many years in England already. And so he goes in as a kind of mediator between the English and the Wampanoag, and he works with Massasoit, persuading Massasoit to forge an alliance with the English. And it's an alliance that holds strong for a number of years, not least because Massasoit's life itself is saved by one of the colonists, Edward Winslow, who brings him through an illness. And so although that colony will, over time, will build real tension for the same kinds of reasons, not least as the English colony grows and they start to need more land, and they, and as they start, the pressures over food begin to grow, they have a peace that holds between the English and Massasoit until really the 1670s. So it's a significantly different start, and the violence that they're involved with then comes from contact and enmity between the settlement and the Wampanoag's own enemies, like the Narragansett. And of course, that kind of relationship that the Wampanoag have with the Narragansett is itself one of the reasons that Massasoit is keen to formalise peace with the English, because he sees them as a means of stopping the Narragansett dominating the Wampanoag. So there's this kind of complex layering of diplomacy going on. And I think the one other thing that's worth mentioning in all of this is that, because we have this image, and it's certainly part of the American foundational myth, of this firstness, right? This of people from England heading into this completely uncharted territory and meeting people who are completely alien and who've never been seen before and who've never seen white people before. And none of that's true, not least because the Spanish and the English have been raiding this coast since the middle of the 16th century, at the very least, and among other things, taking people, taking captives, taking slaves. The Spanish are taking captives from precisely this part of the East Coast from the 1560s onwards. So all of these tribal groups, those who are within reasonable proximity of the coast, they already have an established fear of Europeans and an established distrust of Europeans. But Europeans are heading into that without really understanding the significance of actions that have preceded their settlements. So that tension is there right from the start, and it's kind of fortuitous in the case of the Plymouth colony that Massasoit needs the English as much as the English need the Massasoit, and then obviously the happy chance of Edward Winslow having really bought Massasoit's trust by bringing him through illness, which Massasoit then returns by warning them that natives who have settled, or natives around the new settlement of Wessagusset, are planning to attack Plymouth. So there's this, you know, kind of trust built right from the start that's never really in operation down in Jamestown in Virginia, you know, where uprisings look like they're going to occur. Miles Standish, who's the head of the military at Jamestown, heads in with a hammer, kills leaders, cuts off their heads and sticks them on spikes, and you know, really builds this sense of violence and a reputation for the English among the Powhatan people, and as I say, particularly for leaders like Opechancanough, of an aggressive reprisal awaiting any kind of action, and that just builds the tension even further.